This hour features a discussion of creativity, but perhaps not the kind that springs to mind when you hear the term creativity, because we're not talking about artistic expression in humans, not strictly that anyway. Instead, we'll focus on the kind of creativity that solves problems, like how does my species survive? Our guide for the discussion is Andreas Wagner, or Wagner. He's a professor and chair at the Institute of Evolutionary Biology and Environmental Studies at the University of Zurich. He's also one of many external professors at the Santa Fe Institute and the author of two other books on evolution. Professor Wagner, thanks for joining us. Is he there? Perhaps that is what that phone call was on the outside line a moment ago. Okay, we seem to have lost Professor Wagner. We'll get him back on the line. We've devised a system here, by the way, in case you're wondering, when we do international calls, and he is in Zurich, where instead of having to dial all the numbers necessary for dialing overseas, we have arranged with a service in Portland that takes all those permutations of numbers and gets them on the line. So we got him back? Okay. Dr. Wagner, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So to grasp what you've done in this book, how do we have to expand our definition of creativity?
Yeah, so actually we don't have to expand our definition of creativity much at all. The definition of creativity that I use in the book is something that's used by psychologists, you know, all over the world, and it's based on what is called a creative product that is usually defined as an original and appropriate solution to a problem. So this is creativity defined around problem solving, and creative people are those that are, you know, good at coming up with such original solutions. And what's attractive about this particular definition of creativity is that it applies not just to the human realm, but it also applies to biology. You know, we can think of the history of life as a 4 billion year long history of creative solutions that life has faced to problems that life has faced, such as, for example, how to and to build a more streamlined fish, or to build leaves that extract sunlight better, or to build bacteria that extract nutrients from the soil. So it's a very universal definition of creativity, and that's what makes it attractive for, you know, this particular project that we're talking about today.
So you say you're augmenting Darwinian evolution in the book. What did Darwin leave out that you're filling in here?
Well, augmenting is perhaps a bit of a strong word. What I'm basically doing is that, and I'm transferring some ideas that are important in today's evolutionary biology that actually didn't originate with Darwin, but later, about the early, you know, 20th century, to the human realm. And it's important to realize that that in and by itself is not new. In fact, scientists back to Darwin's time, suspected that that human creativity has a lot in common with Darwinian evolution, but that idea didn't actually really get traction until the 1960s, where it became prominent in psychology through a psychologist of the name of Donald Campbell, I believe it was, who coined the term blind variation and selective retention, the idea that we create new ideas, concepts, images blindly, similar to what random DNA mutation does in Darwinian evolution, and then select those that are particularly apt or fit for a purpose.
Was he the person who studied Picasso's drawings for the what became the painting Guernica?
No, that's another more contemporary scientist. His name is Dean Simonton. Simonton actually, yeah, that was a very interesting study that he did. What he did is he studied the process by which Picasso created a famous mural called Guernica that commemorated the attack of German bombers to a village in Spain, where thousands of people were killed in a bombing raid. And what he discovered through his process, where Picasso, I should back up one step and say that Picasso basically produced dozens of sketches before the mural was finished, and a lot of these sketches are preserved. And one thing that Simonton studied was whether these sketches are sort of a linear progression towards the final painting, you know, a continual improvement towards the final painting, and they're not at all. There's lots of elements in the sketches that you don't find in the final painting. And when Simonton asked several independent judges to rank these sketches compared to, according to their similarity to the final painting, they found that these sketches were all over the place. So Picasso did not actually progress linearly towards this final painting, but the process was very complex, zigzagged, if you will, until he reached the final painting. And this is something that was not really appreciated, for example, in about biological evolution in Darwin's time, but we now know occurs in biological evolution as well.
So I was going to ask you for examples, and I was going to say the fossil record probably wouldn't have a lot of them because the zigs and zags that didn't work died out, right?
Exactly. In order to know that these zigs and zags occur, we actually have to use the latest technology that people, researchers in my laboratory in Zurich employ. But in order to explain what that research is about, I need to back up one step and tell you about another important concept in this regard, and it's the concept of an adaptive landscape. It's something, a concept that Darwin didn't coin. In fact, it was created by a early 20th century American evolutionary biologist of the name of Sewell Wright, a very famous man, who at the time performed fairly complicated breeding experiments on guinea pigs. Okay? And he was working at the USDA at the time, and the USDA was interested in how to improve crops or how to improve livestock by through breeding experiments. So basically, doing evolution on a small scale over a few generations, not over a thousand.
Okay, let's pause there because we need to take a break. We're talking to Dr. Andreas Wagner about his book, Life Finds a Way, What Evolution Teaches Us About Creativity. And the concept of the adaptive landscape or fitness landscape is a rather large one we want to get. So I want to hold this off to the other side of a break. We'll talk more about Sewell Wright with Andreas Wagner. You can join us by phone and email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Professor Andreas Wagner. He's the chair of the Institute of Evolutionary Biology and Environmental Studies at the University of Zurich. And his third book on evolutionary biology is called Life Finds a Way, What Evolution Teaches Us About Creativity. And you think about creativity as problem solving. Well, creatures alive on the planet today have solved problems, challenges to their survival over time. You can join our conversation as we explore the concept further. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's pick up this concept of the adaptive landscape or the fitness landscape. We're talking about the work of Sewell Wright involved in agricultural breeding programs.
Yes, so in the 1920s and 1930s, Sewell Wright was working on guinea pigs to see how breeding programs could be improved. And, of course, nobody's very interested in the milk yield of a guinea pig, but guinea pigs have an advantage over cows and other animals that are agriculturally relevant, and that is that they're small and they breed fast, so you have many generations within a short amount of time. And Sewell Wright took advantage of this fact to see, for example, how breeding could improve the coat color, for example, of guinea pigs. And he was very interested in how genes influence traits such as the coat color. And he discovered in his experiments that genes interact in a very complicated way. It was not so much of a problem for him to describe in which way these genes interact because he was mathematically inclined, but he knew that a lot of biologists at the time were not mathematically inclined. So he was looking for a visual metaphor to describe what he had found, and he came up with this concept that we today still call the adaptive landscape or a fitness landscape. And you can think of such a landscape as describing the topography of solutions to a problem that evolution is facing. For example, how to produce a guinea pig with a shiny coat collar or a leaf that extracts sunlight efficiently from the world around it. So basically, each of these problems have multiple solutions, and you can think of these solutions as forming a landscape where the best solutions from the highest peaks, intermediate solutions, mediocre solutions form, the peaks of the foothills, if you will, and the poorest solution from the valleys. And for many years, this concept, which proved to be very influential in biology in general, was used as a mere metaphor. There's thousands of papers that have been written around it, but really it was just used metaphorically. But that changed with two developments, one of which has nothing to do with biology. It's actual development in computer science in the second half of the 20th century, where computer scientists discovered that they can characterize or define what makes a problem difficult, the kind of problem that computer scientists were interested in. So, for example, how to efficiently route airplanes across, you know, a continent like the U.S. or trucks or something like that. And they discovered that the complex problems are those that have a very complex solution landscape. That is where the solution landscape resembles something like the Rocky Mountains, many peaks and many, many valleys in between, whereas simple problems are those that have a very simple solution landscape, like that of Mount Kilimanjaro, you know, a single mountain, single peak sticking out from a vast plain underneath. So that was the first development. People discovered that there is some deep connection between the topography of a landscape and of an adaptive landscape and problem complexity. The second development was one in biology, and that actually came about not until about 15, 20 years ago. It's something that I describe in some detail in the book, and that is that using technology that came about through the genomics revolution pretty much, we can now characterize and map adaptive landscapes of whole organisms, for example, bacteria that evolve in new environments. That's something that, you know, people, researchers in my lab do, but also of individual molecules, DNA molecules and protein molecules that we evolve in the lab to solve specific problems. For example, how such molecules can make a bacterium more resistant against antibiotics or other drugs. So we can explore thousands of solutions of this problem, thousands of individual molecules, and map these solutions onto a landscape. And what we find is that Wright was fundamentally correct in what he discovered in his guinea pigs, namely these landscapes of evolving molecules and organisms are indeed quite rugged. You know, they have multiple peaks, some of which high peaks, good solutions to the problem, lots of intermediate peaks, but also many different valleys that connect these peaks.
But the highest peak is the best solution. It's not, you can't exactly just settle for the second highest.
Yeah, you don't want to settle for the second highest if you can.
Okay. So I want to understand the work at your laboratory. We're talking to Dr. Andreas Wagner at the Evolutionary Biology and Environmental Studies Institute at the University of Zurich. His book is Life Finds a Way. So are, in essence, with the experiments you do with bacteria and molecules, are you forcing evolution?
Yes. So what we're doing is what's called experimental evolution. So, for example, we would stick a bacterium into an environment that It is very toxic for the bacterium, for example, an environment that contains a lot of salt or that contains some other toxic chemicals, and we leave it there for a few thousand generations, which is not so hard because bacteria divide every 20 minutes, and so a few thousand generations fits in the course of, you know, 2 or 3 months of evolution. And then at the end of this time, we sequence the DNA, that is, we read the letter sequence of the genome of these bacteria. And we study how bacteria adapted to this new environment. Again, nobody's very interested in principle how bacteria adapt, but what we learn from bacteria, we believe, can transfer to other organisms. For example, tolerance to salt is something that is very important for plants, agricultural important crops. For example, when soils get too salty. We think that we can learn something from how bacteria evolve tolerance to salt, how they solve this particular problem, that we can transfer that information to plants and other organisms. So we do this kind of experimental evolution with bacteria, but we also do it with individual molecules, protein molecules, which are strings of smaller building blocks called amino acids that fold into complicated shapes and catalyze chemical reactions. And these reactions are very important for all of life. They're also, for example, important in a process that's called antibiotic resistance. When some proteins, for example, cause bacteria to to become resistant against antibiotics by cleaving, destroying the antibiotics that that medical doctors expose these bacteria to. And by studying how such proteins evolve in the laboratory, we want to find out how bacteria evolve antibiotic resistance and perhaps in the future find ways blocking that antibiotic resistance. But more fundamentally, we're interested in the process of evolution, how evolving proteins or evolving bacteria navigate these very complex landscapes before they get to the highest peaks, to the best possible solution to whatever problem they're facing.
So have you been able to figure out that the manipulation of the protein is critical to determining how genes and cells and living things function?
Yes, you know, within the limits of what we can do with the experimental technology that we have, proteins can be very useful to figure that out. Of course, we don't have final answer. You know, it's all a work in It's all a work in progress.
All right. A lot of fascinating stuff in the book. We're talking to Professor Andreas Wagner at the Institute of Evolutionary Biology and Environmental Studies at the University of Zurich. He chairs that institute. He has written now 3 books on biology. We're talking about the latest called Life Finds a Way, What Evolution Teaches Us About Creativity. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about things like creativity and problem solving and how that extends the duration of species upon the face of the planet and evolutionary adaptive landscapes, fitness landscapes. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's give an example of a rapid change for a creature on the face of the earth. How did the Industrial Revolution, for example, change the peppered moth, as you describe in the book?
Yes, so you know, it used to be thought that, you know, evolution is this glacially slow process, but it's already in the early 20th century that people realized that evolution does not need to be glacially slow. And the peppered moth is a very good example for that. It's, in fact, a textbook example that, you know, students would learn in biology 101 typically. A peppered moth is an organism that is usually well camouflaged when it sits on the surface of certain trees, on the bark of trees, because the color patterns on its wings matches the bark very well. But that changed in the Industrial Revolution when pollution arose and the bark of these trees darkened. So the moths were no longer well camouflaged, so the birds could easily see them there and pick them off. And that process is an example of natural selection eliminating the light-colored moths that were well camouflaged and increased the proportion of frequency in moth populations at the time of dark-colored moths that were now better camouflaged against those soot-covered trees whose bark was darker. Industrial contamination and pollution was reduced again. Trees turned light-colored again, and so did the moths, following them by only a few. Well, following the track of evolution of a track of pollution, at a distance of about 20 or 30 years. So this was a very fast evolutionary process, 20 or 30 years, as I said. But we now know through experimental evolution in the laboratory that evolution can be even faster. We can see evolution in a matter of weeks. In small organisms with very fast generation times.
Well, and then you get to examples, though, that look basically like opposites. Instead of camouflage, we're talking about butterflies that don't hide, but instead show off what they are and who they are.
Yes, that's another example. And I do not know that anybody has studied how fast that happens, but there is butterflies in the Amazon rainforest, like many other butterflies around the world, that have very, very flashy colors. And what these flashy colors usually mean is that they warn off predators. They say, you know, I'm toxic or I don't taste well. And if a predator has once eaten a butterfly with that flashy color pattern, it'll remember that bad taste throughout its life and avoid all butterflies of the same kind. And it's another intriguing evolutionary process, kind of the opposite of camouflage, as you correctly said. But unfortunately, we don't know how fast it occurred. It could have been decades, or it could have been, you know, centuries before these color patterns, or millennia before these color patterns emerged.
I went straight from moths to butterflies, but the chapter that contains them also includes the ancient creatures known as ammonites, which the chambered nautilus is sort of the modern successor to ammonites. What problem did they have to solve? What creativity did that species have to apply?
Yeah, so they have to solve a problem that many water-living creatures solve, and that is, you know, how do you push your body through the water while minimizing resistance? And they had to do this within the constraints of their peculiar body plans, which is this spiral shape. Not very efficient way of swimming, but it turns out that among different spiral-shaped body plans, there are efficiency of swimming differs dramatically. And there was a very interesting study, I think it was done in the 1960s already, that studied systematically how different shapes of these ammonites would differ in their efficiency of swimming by creating plexiglass models of these ammonites and dragging them through the water and measuring the drag resistance. And so in this study, the author basically displayed these possible solutions, these different shapes, as an adaptive landscape where the peaks would correspond to the most efficiently swimming ammonites, and discovered that this landscape actually had a fairly simple shape. It had only two peaks that were separated by a valley, and these two peaks corresponded to two different ammonite shapes that swam maximally efficiently. And when later on some paleontologists superimposed hundreds of different of ammonite shapes that have been found in the fossil record onto these landscapes, they found that it was actually precisely the peaks that were occupied, but not the valleys in between.
So what determines the number of peaks or valleys? Is it the complexity of the organism, the number of genes or chromosomes, the number of letters in its DNA? I mean, what have you been able to figure out over the years about what adds complexity or takes it away from the adaptive or fitness landscape?
Well, you know, I'd love to know the answer. And this is an area of very active research. There's hundreds of laboratories around the world trying to figure out, you know, why some landscapes are simple and why some landscapes are complex. We don't have the answer yet, but, you know, you could think of this as a good thing. You know, we want to leave some questions to be answered for future generations of scientists.
That's very nice of us. Andreas Wagner is our guest on The Exchange. His book is called Life Finds a Way, What Evolution Teaches Us About Creativity. The chapter on inbreeding contains a number of surprises, including a description of the ways in which King Tutankhamun in ancient Egypt was deformed.
Yes, so this relates to, and here I probably, you know, should back up one step as well to give you a little bit of context of, you know, why I would talk about somebody like Tutankhamun. It has to do with a peculiar problem that natural selection has in traversing or exploring such landscapes with a complex topography. What evolution does is basically it creates through processes like DNA mutations first a diversity of solutions to a problem, and then selection preserves those that work best. And through an iterated cycle of mutation and selection, solutions get successively improved. And you can think of this process, you can think of the action of selection specifically as dragging evolving organisms or pushing them up the nearest hill or peak in such a landscape. So selection can only move uphill in such a landscape. And if you think about this in a complex landscape, this creates a huge problem. The problem is, how do you actually get from that peak, if it's a low peak, you know, a foothill, let's say, to the next valley that separates it from the next higher peak? And how do you get from that next higher peak through the next valley that separates it from the next higher peak? So in a complex landscape, you sometimes have to traverse valleys, poor solutions, if you will, to get to the next better solutions. And one thing that Darwin didn't know, couldn't have known about, is that natural selection is not sufficient for that. We need other mechanisms of evolution. And one such mechanism was already discovered, in fact, by Sewell Wright and collaborators in the early 20th century. It's called genetic drift. And it is a process that I would have to go into more, you know, would need more time than we have right now, but it's detailed in some detail in the book how this process works. But you can think of it as shaking an adaptive landscape, like a constant earthquake, and it basically allows sometimes to push organisms through a valley into the next, towards the next peak. And this process, genetic drift, is manifest also in something that we call inbreeding. And this is where Tutankhamun and other royal families come in that were subject to extensive inbreeding. And what inbreeding does is basically it indiscriminately brings out bad genes in a population or in a family lineage. And sometimes the consequences of this process can be disastrous, such as, for example, Tutankhamun's bloodline, which went extinct a few thousand years ago. But in other cases, like many animals and plant species that suffer inbreeding for some time, it can actually be a route through ascending the next higher peak in a landscape. So inbred organisms that do very poorly in whatever environment they live are organisms that live in a valley, if you will, of an adaptive landscape. And they can go either extinct, which is a bad outcome, or when they persist long enough in this valley, new mutations...
Okay, back in the exchange in 1 minute.
Push.
Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Andreas Wagner, professor and chair at the Institute of Evolutionary Biology and Environmental Studies at the University of Zurich. He is an evolutionary biologist and the author of now 3 books on evolution, including the latest called Life Finds a Way, What Evolution Teaches Us About Creativity. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we make our way through adaptive landscapes where creatures have to go up the highest peaks to move on in the world and to stay on the planet. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So to pick up the thread here on what we were just talking about, genetic drift plus inbreeding emphasizes traits that might otherwise die out?
It basically is a mechanism that allows organisms to traverse valleys on their way to the highest adaptive peaks. And it illustrates that actual natural selection is not all-powerful. It's, in fact, quite a limited force to explore adaptive landscapes. So evolution needs other forces in addition to natural selection. One of them is called genetic drift. Another one is called recombination. And that happens in a form of shuffling the DNA of organisms whenever they reproduce sexually. And what you can think of recombination as helping organisms make large jumps through an adaptive landscape. So if they're stuck in a valley somewhere, through these jumps, they can actually get to a different region of the landscape, hopefully closer to a next higher peak. And recombination is very important, we know, because the vast majority of organisms use some form of recombination. It turns out there's only a very small number of them that don't, and many of them seem to be on their way to extinction. So a life without sex and recombination seems to be not a good thing for a variety of reasons.
Certainly, yeah, a variety. That's a good way to put it. It seems, though, you get quickly in the book to a discussion of places where the population for breeding is limited, like islands, like the Galapagos, where Darwin studied. So how exotic are some of the evolutionary adaptations necessary for creatures to survive in such a place?
Yeah, so islands have actually produced, you know, very, very exotic creatures. You know, think about the Galapagos with the blue-footed boobies, or marine iguanas, you know, also unique in the world, giant tortoises, and a variety of fauna that you find, well, nowhere else in the world. And it's actually an illustration of the power of genetic drift to help organisms find new solutions and original solutions to the problems of survival. And the link here between islands and genetic drift is the following. We know, again, for reasons that are explained in more detail in the book, that genetic drift is especially strong, an especially strong pushing force to get organisms through valleys when population sizes are small. And this is something that's very typical of island species. You know, for example, if a new species of bird invades an island that has emerged from the seafloor through a volcano eruption, for example, there's usually a very small number of individuals at first because they may have to fly or get swept by wind, you know, for 1,000 kilometers from land, as was the case in the Galapagos. And these initially small island populations, if they manage to survive for a while, they suffer genetic drift and inbreeding, and this process can help them find new adaptive peaks and diversify very rapidly. So there is many island species that have actually undergone many speciation events in a very, very short amount of time. And perhaps the most iconic example are the Galapagos finches that were discovered by Darwin, where there's 14 species that have all originated within a few million years. But there's even more dramatic examples, such as, for example, some Hawaiian species, insect species, there's 4,000 speciation events within the last 4 or 5 million years, which is very, very rapid species formation. And most of that is driven by the power of genetic drift in combination with a new island environment that these species get to explore.
And, you know, the finches, as you mentioned, get to get into some fairly exotic species like the vampire finches. They actually feed on other creatures?
That's correct, yes. So there's lots of unique island lifestyles. Predatory caterpillars. You know, we think of caterpillars as these leaf-munching creatures, rather peaceful, but there is some that, you know, basically ambush their insect prey and kill it very efficiently. And it's a unique caterpillar lifestyle evolved on an island.
Wow, all kinds of great stuff in here. Let's take some phone calls. We have Al in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andreas Wagner, the author of Life Finds a Way.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question, like two parts. One is, I have noticed in volcanic area, if they were next to like rolling hills, which is probably brown or color compared to the black volcanic area, the rabbits in the volcanic area are black and their ears kind of drooping, while the one in the rolling hills are brown, or whatever, jackrabbits. And the other question is, I think in the 90s, there was a study that was done in Monterey Bay in California, where they have noticed certain organisms, since it's the water column is really deep, that the organism, they change, I think, their DNA instantaneously as they go up the column to suit the new pressure and light. So I would like to know, is that due to variations, or, I mean, I assume the rabbit's more complex than the other organism.
Okay, but the excellent question, sure. Al. Thanks for that. So protective coloration in rabbits and organisms changing DNA as they come up the water column.
Yeah, so the protective coloration in rabbits, you know, I'm not familiar with any studies that have been done on this, but, you know, these protective coloration patterns and their change with the environment are extremely abundant. So this is not something that you only see in the peppered moth. For example, you also see it in mice, whether they live on, you know, in a meadow or in a sandy area, their coat color changes very, very dramatically with the environment. So what you're saying there is entirely plausible. Regarding the water column, and I believe you were talking about microbes there, I'm not surprised at all. We know, for example, that also in the water column in the ocean, the microbes in there and the plankton in there show adaptations to specific elevations that may have to do with nutrient abundance or light availability. And these adaptations are mediated, of course, by differences in their genome. So no surprise there at all. And in fact, in microbes, because they have such short generation times, we would expect these adaptations to occur a whole lot more rapidly than in more complex organisms like rabbits.
Let's talk about the complexity of organisms and the size, for that matter, because it seems like there is a relationship in genetic drift with animal size. What have you found over the years?
Yeah, so it turns out that genetic drift, as I said, is much stronger in small populations. And because larger animals live, also intend to live in smaller populations, There's just not enough. It is not as elephants need much more space than mice, and bacteria need much less space than mice. Smaller organisms also live in much larger populations, and therefore genetic drift is much weaker in them. So drift tends to be stronger in large organisms. But that effect of drift may be countervailed by the fact that natural selection has a harder time to push organisms up the hills or the peaks of an adaptive landscape, because it's also not quite as effective as in large populations. And this is another area of active research. A lot of people would like to know how natural selection and drift interact, and that's still something, a question where we don't really have final answers yet.
Okay, a lot more work in the lab then at the University of Zurich. Let's take another call here from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andreas Wagner.
Good morning. Fascinating discussion. I love the metaphor of peaks and valleys. I have been a catastrophist for most of my life when I look at the world. And I'm wondering if we can find evidence of these peaks and valleys and trace them perhaps over time in the human genome. And I'll take my answer off here.
Okay. Thanks for that, Paul. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So that's a very interesting question here. The human genome is a hugely complex, you know, piece of DNA, 3 billion letters, you know, in 46 chromosomes. And we would love to do what you're asking, whether we can do for any one trait, you know, of humans. And unfortunately, you know, we're not quite there yet. And part of the reason why people like me work with much simpler systems, you know, bacteria, whose genome is typically 1/1,000th the size of the human genome, where we can actually find mapped peaks and valleys, and where these landscapes, the corresponding landscapes, have been shown to be somewhat rugged. And it's even easier to do this with individual genes or proteins when we evolve them in the lab, because, you know, the DNA that encodes a typical protein is only about 1,000 letters long. So again, 1/1,000th of the size of a microbial genome. So I'm sure we'll get there for humans at some point, but I'm afraid we're not quite there yet.
And is the limit in moving into more complex creatures computation space in computers or space in lab or is it just too complex?
It's basically, you know, for humans, of course, there is, you know, serious ethical considerations,
right, sure, yeah,
for, you know, primates and mammals, of course, but then it's also a matter of complexity and simply time. It's much, you know, complexity in terms, it's much harder, for example, to manipulate the genome of a mouse than it's to manipulate the genome of a bacterium. And again, if you want to study evolution, it's much better to do it with a small organism like a bacterium than with a mouse, although, you know, it could be done in mice because you can fit so many more generations into a small amount of time. And I should perhaps add, you know, the most important amount of time is typically the length of time that it needs to get a PhD, right? because these kinds of experiments are often done by PhD students. So you have 3 to 4 years or something like that. And, you know, you don't want to do an experiment that takes 20 years. People do these experiments, but it's, you know, a career-defining activity.
Well, let's talk, though, about, because artificial intelligence is brought into the book at some point here. And have computers been set up with tasks to emulate, simulate, in some way recreate evolution in a computer model?
Yeah, so that's, in fact, a very, very important branch of computer science that, you know, comes under a variety of names, one of them called evolutionary computation, another one called genetic algorithms. And the name genetic algorithms actually gives it away already. These are algorithms, that is, recipes that can be followed by a computer that mimic evolution. They use, you know, they basically encode particular problems that need to be solved in a computer, and then they solve these problems by first generating mutations, that is, creating random variations of solutions for these problems, and then selecting those that work best. And these genetic algorithms have actually been proven to be enormously successful. In fact, they can create on a par with humans. So, for example, they have produced patentable electronic circuits, patentable, you know, antennas that work in outer space. In fact, patents have been granted two creations of these genetic algorithms. And what's also intriguing is that, you know, they don't just use natural selection and mutation. They also use these other forces, for example, recombination. It's very well known in the community of people who study genetic algorithms that that recombination is essential to get unstuck from a valley in an adaptive landscape.
It's bringing in new DNA. It's basically, it's mating. It's sex.
Exactly, exactly. Mating in the computer.
So before we go, I want to ask you about computers and creative pursuits outside of genetic algorithms and things like that, because you bring in Emmy, the composing computer, and there's a link to the University of Oregon in this story, which is in our listening area.
Yes. So, it's always a question whether the creativity as problem-solving could also apply to the arts. And it's clear already that it will apply to some extent to the arts, because there is genetic algorithms that produce melodies and compositions that are even being performed by bodies like the London Symphony Orchestra and get good critical reviews. A lot of people are very skeptical about how far this kind of algorithmic art and music can be pushed. I'm a bit agnostic about it, but I'm often reminded of the words of a famous art historian of the 20th century, a person from Yale University, who said, all major works of art are hard-won solutions to some problems. And coming back to Emmy, yes, that's a computer composition algorithm that became famous because it could churn out thousands and thousands of composition in the style of particular composers. And it goes to show how some of these principles of evolution, some of which Emmy used, are universal and have applications in many domains of creative expression.
Okay, the book really makes you think. The book is called Life Finds a Way, What Evolution Teaches Us About Creativity. Andreas Wagner at the University of Zurich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Take care. That's it for today's exchange. Our producers are John Backstrom, April Ehrlich, Randy Babbitt, Madison Hamilton at the controls. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Have a great day.